You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins, and I'm your host today for Science to Sage Radio. I'm always your host. And today our special guest is Lee Mikowski. He is a modern Renaissance man. His interest in knowledge and study and learning range from art, acting, music, history, religion, philosophia, esotericism, to string theory, quantum physics, and multidimensional nature of consciousness. Wow. He has deeply studied Hermeticism, alchemy, the Kabbalah, and has hosted twice weekly philosophical salons at his home in Oleander for over 30 years. He has written and illustrated and published 6 books. He's lectured both nationally and internationally and has been given numerous talks and presentations on the holographic art and the visual philosophy. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
How are you? I'm good. Thanks for being on the show today. And, you know, I want to start right off the bat because you have a place that's that you've created, which is your studio, which is where you have had your revelations. And I would love you to describe to the audience that intimate space that you've created, where part of where Adam Reborn and Eve Restored is painted from ceiling to wall. So why don't you start with that and give us a clue.
Your introduction talking about the 33 years of discussion groups here in my home really set the stage for the painted studio, which is in my home, which began on 9/11/2001 when the towers came down. But it is, and just to give a verbal description, it is a painted library studio that began not as a conceit to paint the whole thing, but actually as this realization on 9/11 that we really have to come up with a context for the story of being human that allows us to find this journey of who and what we are something remarkable, something truly worthy of a sense of wonder, because it will be those things that help to awaken our sense of greater human possibility. And this is why the footprint of it being in my home, where community has gathered in generosity and enthusiasm and in curiosity, that what has happened in my studio to me is very much like a garden that I didn't expect to have grow, but it's because of creating residence for these ideas about who are we, why are we here, what's our purpose, you know, really all the interesting questions, became the foundation or the fertile soil from which this, what I think of as a creative epiphany, has emerged, because I, again, didn't expect to be doing this. But it began, and over really the last 12 years, it has grown to become what I think of as a return to the beginning. We began in the painted cave. In the painted cave, we see that the technology is storytelling, paint, and imagination. And that's what happens when we come back home, when we come to Olandar, my home, and when we see this painting, the hieroglyph of the human soul. It reminds us that we are an art form. We are the outcome of this gathering of a great library called What Does It Mean to Be Human? We finally return to the cave, meaning we return to the truth that we are the technology. And like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, the metaphor here is we finally find our way home. And home is a place where we are intimate with each other, where we tell the truth nakedly with each other, and where it's not who's in charge, but how do we make something out of this life? How do we navigate this world together? So it's full of a deep love of human knowing, the library of human consciousness, and the sense of we're finally finding home. So that's my thumbnail sketch.
Well, you know, when I've been to your home, and I think when I've had the experience of being and walking up the stairs, and there's a massive figure, which is the watcher. Would I call that right? He's the watcher.
Yeah.
And then you actually go into this big studio space, and it is generous in space. But what they need to know is it's not that it's just the library, but you've painted over your books. You've painted on the sofas. And what I had the experience coming into your space was the floor was actually very mercurial. It was very liquid and very fluid. And it was almost as though you could actually sink into it. But when you actually rose to the ceilings were more solid and concrete. It's like we had gone from something very lovely and something we were constructing to something that was more. And everything that you have is accumulation of many different cultures that you fused. So why don't you explain this big library and tapestry, that because you have many cultures sitting in that big vista.
Part of my 9/11 impulse, I realized, was this Noah feeling, that the last flood was water, and this flood is information, and we have it just, the question of how do we navigate this flood of information, and what do we realize is real, and what is only actual, and that's why the relationship to a type of synthesis is very important and a key to all of this returning home. And I think that one of the great metaphors, I always make the joke metaphor, is that the grail or the chalice that appears here is over the spines of the books of religion and ancient traditions. And what is really remarkable about this symbolism, because it wasn't something, in a sense, it's far more clever than I would have been consciously what happened, because what it did is it started to say that when we return home, that we will realize the outcome of all different traditions, all different religions, all different human interactions are an examination of what does it mean to be human, and that question was so fascinating, was so impossible to answer in one particular direction, because we are not a project of analysis. We are an art form of creation, meaning that like an electron following all of its probable paths, this is what creates essentially the spin, the greater nature of our inheritance, like a great tree, that is the outcome of all of this journeying through all of these traditions. And so I think that that's why, because in my work on the tarot, my work on Adam Reborn and Eve Restored, all of this work with archetype and with mythic imagery has taught me that it's not about who was right or who was wrong, but really, like Joseph Campbell said, that the artist of every generation must reinvigorate the myths, because it really is incumbent upon the creative, which is not an individual looking for a belief system or something to prove or disprove, because that leads to argumentation, defending, and ultimately war, but rather the creative being is really looking for the sense of who am I? What are the clues to my inheritance as being human? And if I only look at one tradition, then I will see myself through that lens, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's like looking through one facet of a particular jewel. And for me, it was that sense of all of these traditions, like all the artists. I mean, when people say, who's your favorite artist? I always think, well, all of them. I love the process of creative exploration. It's not a hierarchy. It's actually looking in all of these directions like a great circle. And so that's really what I see in terms of the relationship here of this gathering. People ask about the tarot, about why I have so many different traditions involved in those images as well. And it really was not a conscious choice. It came from following the creative impulse, which I had learned as an actor, which isn't to prove something, but to really step into its mystery and allow it to mentor you. And this is really what's happened to me over the years, that the library, which I gathered over the last 30 years, has reflected not simply my curiosity, but a growing sense of the story of humanity that needs to move beyond simply what we see or know into a sense that how we honor the ancestors, how we honor those that have gotten us here, and how we honor those who are around us now, is to stand like an actor does on the stage and say, this is a matter of ensemble, and if I can learn from everybody I'm standing with, and I don't turn to them to teach me, but I learn from them, because I know that as I listen, as I hear, as I read, as I research, it will restore to me the realization that I have far more capacity than I ever dreamt possible. And if my art is a proof of anything, that's its proof, because I didn't expect this to happen. And it happened because of the questions I asked, not the conceits I held.
No, I like the fact that you asked the questions. And then with that, you came up with Adam Reborn and Eve Restored. And having been in your studio, it is an accumulation. So what have you done to restore or Eve and to give Adam and to make him reborn? But before you answer that, here's what I want to invite. If you're online, which most of you are obviously doing, do go to Lee's website, and do look while we're talking at his space. The books are sitting there. You can see exactly what we're talking about. And so go visit LeeMcLowski.com. So anyway, Lee, go ahead and explain. How did you come to that new version?
Just in terms of my process as well, is that because I don't try to illustrate something, and the best thing for me was I really had no conceit of ever revisioning Genesis or having anything to do with the story of Adam and Eve. So I was astounded more than anybody when in the process of allowing this, the studio is called The Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, and that was the revealed name. And we had talked about the watcher at the top of the stairs. What happened on 9/11 was a language called the watcher language emerged, which was a type of spontaneous calligraphic language, really following the dance, not figuring out the dance, but just allowing the music to move me. So using this approach, which is really very much like calligraphy, connected to breath, gesture, emotion, I started to paint the pillar. I have a light pillar, literally a lamp, so you have a light being. It's great. On the lamp, I started to paint what began as just a figure, and then as it emerged, it started to tell me a story, which is what I'd learned as an actor. You can't know how to play a part. You have to put into the crucible all the different elements, and then your imagination starts to really allow it to go through a process of interconnecting and inspiration, and then you find it becomes something living. And this is really what happened with Eve, is that as she developed, she started to tell me a story, and I started to listen, the same way I learned to listen as an actor, that you have to listen to this inner conversation. And what was astounding to me is as she emerged, she told me the story of Adam reborn and Eve restored, a romance in two parts. And she then talked about this truth that to make sense of who and what we are as human, we must revisit our assumption about Adam and Eve, about the first parents. Why have we believed for so long that women are not equal to men? Why is God a male figure and not a female figure? What was this? Why did we leave the goddess? Why did we essentially move into this period of human perception? And she tells a beautiful story, it's my third book, of how universal Adam becomes, his mind becomes atomized. He becomes lost in the universes of his own creative curiosity. And from this feeling of being lost, under the complexity of time's burdens and infinite worlds, Sophia, the great mother, begins to cry, realizing the anguish of Adam. And so from her tears then, the immaculate Eve emerges into each of Adam's worlds to remind him of home, to remind him of paradise. But the separation of the original atomization creates a darkness in Adam that finally grows to the point where he can no longer see his beloved. And so he turns away from her and turns toward history and time and war and righteousness and judgment and condemnation. But the beautiful part of the story is, and again, I didn't expect it, but the universal Adam dies, but he ends up returning the gift that I gave you, the gift of horizons to call your own. In other words, that he was the quality that guided us through this dark night. And so it comes to a point now of Adam reborn, meaning it is time to know that we are the outcome of a great and difficult journey of becoming human and ultimately worthy of true relationship, where we no longer need an overlord, but we need to look back into one another's eyes and to realize that the lover and beloved, Adam and Eve, are repeated in every male and female, and that as we gather that story, we will honor that each of us then, that this love affair was so great that it needed each of us to explore its infinite possibility in time. And it's a really beautiful story and something I never expected to tell, but it came directly. It was really a very inspired, in the old days it would have been called a revelation. But it's a creative, I think of it as a creative revelation, because again, I didn't expect to have this conversation, but it is so beautiful and I think so terribly important to trying to make sense of who and what we are now, because we have to make sense of our myth at this point. Otherwise, we're just going to try and, with intelligence, figure out how to fix the problems. And the problems aren't external, they're internal. And I think this story goes a long way to helping us to create. A lot of my work, I feel like an archaeologist. I just didn't stop where others stopped. I kept digging and went deeper and found that in these deep foundational energies is a story of love really trying to reassert itself to say, fall in love with this thing called being human. It's a difficult journey. It's been difficult forever, but there's a reason you are an art form, and that you could say every flower struggles to finally blossom, but it is the very nature of its true inner beauty, its fragrance, its awakening, that is and explains the seasons that we go through. And I say we are here to blossom. So that's, you know, that's really my look at Adam Reborn and Eve Restored.
Well, Gene has a question. Gene's here with me, and he's my co-host often. And go ahead, Gene, you have a question.
Lee, having looked at a lot of the things that relate to where we've come from and our existence here, and sometimes referring back to Adam, and having seen transformations from what we think of as some paradisical nature there, and I've tried to put that into a concept of language and considered it to be an Adamic language, something that was spoken at that time, which would have had a form of perfection within it, but something that was probably spoken in perhaps simple words, but more spoken in concepts and ideas. And as you spoke here of going back to this rebirth, it struck me that how you have received this probably came through an Adamic language being spoken to you in the forms of pictures, concepts, and bundles of information. And I'm wondering if you have considered that as an aspect of this language being spoken here, which is somewhat of a universal one, rather than the mixed language we have now.
Well, that's very insightful, because it does come from the Watcher language, that she is woven of entity. The Watcher language, just in terms of this Adamic language, why I very much agree with you, is that the language that emerges, and that all of this hieroglyph of the human soul, Adam reborn, Eve restored, all is woven of, is not, as you say, sort of the conceits of the language of what I have learned, but actually much more of a type of rhythmic communion, meaning like the stepping into the dance and the dance mentoring us, allowing us to move. And as we move, in the movement itself is the revelation, in the gesture is the meaning. And that's what I understand about why this is so important, is that the Watcher language says, because what is also extraordinary is that when you put on chroma depth glasses or 3D glasses with this environment or Eve, they become multidimensional. Literally, you look into multidimensional space. But unlike 3D in a movie, which is in motion and taking us somewhere, this is fixed 3D. And it's also philosophical, because it says if you look at this without the glasses, you will see it one way. If you look at it with the glasses on, it will become multidimensional. You're looking at the same thing, but you're beginning to see how the same thing can carry very different implication depending on how we look at it. This is why I do believe that this ancient Adamic language says that we are based in the first principle, the life principle. Life is not particular to one particular time. It is actually the cause and source of all time. And therefore, the ancient Adamic languages are those that connect us like a root system to the quality of our humanness, which is not based in math or separation, but actually in unification and spontaneous creation. And why I say this is that I learned during the work on the archetypes, on the tarot, the work with the Watcher language, is that our language is, because we are so mathematical, when we are born, we move into a mathematical universe of time, space, distance. So we use those tools to try and engineer a sense of who and what we are. So we have a very mathematical sense of where we need to be, who we think we are. And what's very interesting is that the other languages, which we find in the arts, are those of spontaneous creation that says that you cannot know something distilled and predetermined like a book you've taken off the shelf and just reading analysis. But actually, every idea is alive, and therefore, as it awakens through us, it wishes through relationship to awaken in a way that it cannot know itself except through our willingness to enter into this mystery, into this sense of not knowing. And I think of this as the creative state, where you simply are not needing to figure out, but you're actually allowing things to emerge and to teach you rather than to be the explanation of what you're trying to illustrate. So that's why I think so a bit of the difference. Is that, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And just one more comment relating to that. Do you feel perhaps then through this, you've used the word awakening, and I think that possibly then all that we are knowing now, we have perhaps known before, and if we're just awakening it, then we're becoming a greater part of who we are. Perhaps we're in this slower speed of light here, or living in the existence we're in at this point. We sense that there's more beyond what we can actually see here, so there is a higher form of light as well. So do you see us in this awakening restoring something that we already had?
Well, one of the things that has come so strongly to me is that we are ancient trees who have forgotten that we have roots. And so we look to the ground, to the floor, and we only see where we seemingly stop. We don't realize that we actually go deeper than just the surface of things. And I do think that more and more, this is in the studio as well, that we are on an environment where we look down into the depths, and although we are not dissolving into them, we are supported by them, we start to realize that where the linoleum ends and the imagination begins is not one form dissolving another, but actually one form supporting now a deeper connectedness, but that connectedness will be our imagination, our capacity to engage a type of relationship that isn't to prove something, but actually to enter into something. And so that's that sense of growing up out of the root system. And that's actually what the end of the Mayan calendar, I always talk about, that it's very significant that it ended on the winter solstice, because the solstice is when we stop moving forward in time and stand erect, like the axis mundi of the Earth, rather than following the outward turning changes of the weather and identifying with the sense of the movement in the world. We start to stand erect and realize that all that movement, because we are ancient trees, it's actually the alchemy that conditions our unique expression, but it doesn't define us. And I think we have been defined by our movement through time so much by a sense of getting somewhere, having to do something, and now we are coming full circle to a point of alignment where it's not learning anything. It's like puberty. It's something we're going through. It's not something we're going to figure out. And when we know that, then to me, it's a bit like an electrical cable that's been floating on the surface and finally plugs in, and that it then sets into the neurology an awakening from within of the light of mind. Literally, we go from Homo sapien to Homo luminous, but we don't dissolve the Homo sapien. We simply go from I think, therefore I am, to combining it with the knowledge of I love, therefore I am. In a sense, the two hemispheres come to work together.
An enlightenment.
Both.
Here's a question that I have, Lee, for you, because it kind of goes back to even the form of the Watchers, for those who haven't gone to the website. Is when I was looking at the language of the Watchers, which I think is really interesting, is it starts with spin. And it spins out a buildings on a musical scale, and what that kind of reminds me is the vortice of how life begins is with our spin, and what we look at as mathematical is the geometry, but what you're doing is you're building the scale and you're building the visuals with actually the visuals which create its own geometry, which I think is interesting. And in your work on the mothership that you've done, the mothership in pink, you talk a lot about matter and patter, mother, right. Father, and matter being pattern. And this goes back to me, the notion of Adam and Eve, is the mother and the father, the matter and the patterns that are created, and the language of the creative forces that we do. So when I look at even your mothership in pink, I mean, that one is a story where you're talking about the chalice and the female divine and how we take the journey. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think it dovetails with Adam and Eve.
Well, it's very interesting because mothership revelations in pink is, again, another unexpected entity that's emerged in the process of this exploration. And there's a remarkable story that she brings with her, because the relationship when we have physics of the particle and the wave, in this, it's showing how the watcher language, the wave, the weave, is how we create the tapestry, essentially weave together this living membrane of history and time and possibility, building a form through all of these different qualities and conditions. But the mothership shows us in this Revelations in Pink the story of energy, because she is composed of particles or orbs, spheres, and that becomes a very interesting sign, because she says, I am matter, mater, mother. I am the weave of all worlds. All are born through me. All awaken through me. All are woven through me. Therefore, to make sense of yourself, you must return to the knowledge of your energy. Your father, Adam, is the knowledge of your form. I am the knowledge of your ancient knowing. Therefore, she says, there are no evil atoms. If you don't like the stories you tell, tell better stories. Begin with the story you tell yourself about who you think you are. And in that, she says, so to know who you are, you must once again know this journey of the cross of matter, mater, mother, meaning this process of ensheathing that is mirrored in the process of the womb as we go from reptilian to mammalian to hominid. This is very important because she says in this knowledge is the knowledge that we do not grow out of things without condition, but actually everything, like rings in a tree, builds upon the foundation that precedes us, and that we have been building a foundation, like rings in a tree, of greater and greater capacity. This also mirrors the Mayan calendar and the teachings of the Maya, that like vertebra, like rings in a tree, we have been creating for thousands of years a vehicle that can hold its own greater implication without being swept away. This is very important because why the home metaphor, but why the knowledge of the mother has to return through the domestic space, because she says, I love all my children. I embrace the right. I embrace the left. There are no evil atoms. And this is very important for us because we want to stand in the formal mind, in the mathematical mind, and point a finger and say, they're the bad guys. But that's like looking at the left side of your body and saying, that's the bad side. It is an integrated organism. And the other thing, and it's very important for all of us, is she says, I'm the mother of all of my children, not just you children in time, but all children in all ages, in all time. So to know the knowledge of the, essentially the sorrows and joys of your human journey, to make sense of why it is so difficult to be human, you must finally return to the knowledge of your ancient energies, that you're not born into time, you're born into creation. You are whole and holy and holographic, and it is up to you to decide on a story that allows you to not only observe the gift of the apple in this story. The gift of the apple is the gift of our unique artistry of human consciousness, meaning we can now hold our unique identity. It will not be dissolved, but we can finally surrender into our ancient energies. And that's the point of Revelations in Pink. She says, enough with the Revelations in Black and White. We've all read it. It's not a good story. Even the people that survive are not happy. Tell a story you can live with. Find your way home. And by the way, no one can be angry at pink. So lighten up a bit. Have a bit more fun. Remember to play. Humans are not the grown-ups of the universe. We do not remember who we are or why we're here. So we might as well enjoy our ignorance a bit more than we do. Because it's all art.
When you're talking about the seed, and then you know you've gone from the notion of the journey and the matter and the pattern, and then you have, okay, well, let's go into the tarot, because all of a sudden now we're looking at archetypes.
Yes.
And that seems like a perfect transition in the sense of, you know, your language is unfolding with these geometry of the one, and then we're revisiting Adam and Eve. We go to the mothership and we're looking about how we create matters and patterns, and then we go into our story, and our story has to do with archetypical sort of the construct of actually what we choose.
And that's important, because one of the keys to my tarot, and I didn't do this with an intentionality I just did not respond to a tarot, a color tarot. So my drawings for the tarot that took 17 years for the 22 drawings and the book I wrote called Tarot Revision, which is a labor of love and really worth a read, because it took me very deep, and I know it'll help people very much who are interested in these things, because it just went deeper and deeper into what I started to understand, that if we look at the black and white tarot as you would look at a piano, and you start to understand that all of the different notes, all the different characters, the archetypes, could be looked at as different ages, different doors we walk through in history, which will be the repetition of being human, but through a different archetypal lens, a different archetypal construct. And that finally we go through all of these different archetypal doors in black and white. We can liken this again to the Mayan calendar, meaning that we've been going through the keys of consciousness. An E is not F, an F is not G. So we start to understand that when we take a musical sense, or the black and white sense, the piano sense, that we can begin to understand that this is really related to our journey through what we have called the time of the Father, or I think, therefore I am, because it goes back to really Hermes and the advent of the breaking away from the mother goddess, this sense of why did we move into naming things, why did we move into isolating this is this and not that, looking at Aristotle. Why did we have that sense of ourselves through contrast? And if we look at that not as a final product, but actually as the construction of an archetypal vehicle, meaning that we have now constructed in the human psyche these keys of consciousness, like an instrument. And so the question then became, once the archetypal structure, the mythic structure, the knowledge of I think, therefore I am, is established, then we start to create the foundation for the next question, which is how do we take the keys now in black and white and remember, like a piano, that when we start to play the keys, it's not about the notes at all. It's actually about the music that the notes are able to finally support. And so this I see as through art, through spontaneous creation, through this sense that we are an art form of consciousness. That everything in my work, because, again, I've used it as a vehicle of asking questions rather than illustrating something I thought I knew, that what it's revealing to me is that, and again, it's sort of this Wizard of Oz overlay, that we go from the land of black and white and archetypal structure, the keys, into the living, multidimensional depths of the knowledge of the Great Mother, which is the knowledge of I love, therefore I am, because she says, in my depths, you remember, that your humanity is not based simply in this motion through time, these different doors of separation and unique notes, but you finally ascend into my knowledge, which is you return to the truth that you are the technology, that it is your imagination and storytelling that will free you, because as the mother, I say now, you have access to all of these stories of being human. So it is up to you now to look at all of this context and begin to tell a story of being human that you can live with. And in the structure of my home, what's very interesting is that I designed the studio below my studio upstairs, which has the painted library. Downstairs, I designed the room for my father, which is a sunroom. It's literally S-U-N, but it's designed by the sun for the father, where we see the archetypes in black and white, this structure that comes from the father saying to the son, son, these are the laws, and dad, what's expected of me in this world out there, to finally ascending into this other conversation that is not one or the other, but one creating literally the foundation that allows us to ascend into the other, but then to re-descend back through the law of structure. A bit like Dorothy, you know, she goes to Oz, But where does she go back? She goes back to the land of black and white. But she'll finally be able to make sense of these human difficulties, because now she will have ascended into color, and forever she will breathe a greater sense of humanity into no matter what difficulty she experiences in that land of black and white. So I think that there's a huge construction of a deep metaphor in all of this.
Well, there's that's something that comes to mind. As a creative person that you are, and in the process, what keeps coming up is the idea of relationships and communication. And not only are we communicating, you always say, but you have access, and we are the technology, which I totally agree. Having my own creative processes and getting my own downloads, but you obviously are open and understand that we are, like you say, we are the technology. And what I've understood very much is the notion of biomimicry, where we are always mimicking with our technology what really are the inner workings of our own beingness, whether it's computers or plumbing or whatever. The list is infinite. And so, yes, I do agree that we are ourselves the technology, but we also have the technology to access the higher source of what you call the tree and the ancestors. And so can you explain that process of how you actually go into accessing this? Because you have it, obviously you're asking a question and things begin to emerge.
I started to understand. See, I was always very fascinated with everything with astronomy and physics and all this, but I realized that my language was not the language of math. Certainly, like with my father, his language was math, and so I honored it. I was fascinated, read about math, you know, and all this. But I realized that my language was creation, meaning it was the capacity to step into not knowing rather than into, let's say, mathematical knowing, which is about proving a theory. And this is why I realized that we have to move beyond it's either or, one is right and the other is wrong. It's like, no, not really, not at all, because the mathematical mind will allow us to put rovers on Mars. You know, that there's a great and important element to that. But it's the type of overlay where we're looking for technical answers or machine-like answers to human consciousness, or we come up with a type of analytical mathematical profile that has no empathy or compassion or imagination, but everything is bottom-lined, and human beings are then reduced to being nothing but number. And of course, this was the sin of David. He reduced the people of Israel to number. So he was considered in that time a mortal sin, because you take a living being and turn them into a quantity. And they are a quality, not a quantity. It is not one person and one person equals two persons. You have two living beings, unique universes in and of themselves. So that's why I feel my science is the science of creation, meaning that I was asking the same questions that a physicist would be asking about the multidimensional nature of consciousness or holography. But my sense process was always that stepping into the not knowing of something. In other words, as an actor, and I would say that my basic motive is really, I would liken it to the actor's creative approach, which is that an actor is not trying to, as I say, prove something, not trying to prove a point, but actually trying to align with and allow for a very different quality of energy to mediate through the actor to allow the truth of that character, which is a type of tonal truth. It's not something. It's much more like listening to Mozart. You know it because it feels right. So you're dealing with a whole different category of human instrumentation, which has to do with empathy, ensemble, listening, interacting, realizing that it is not you or me, but actually between you and me, that we create an amplification of quantum energy. But I look at that really as the amplification of imaginative energy, meaning that we suddenly, like with brainstorming, where it's not one or the other, but between both, there's an excitement, there's an enthusiasm, there's a raising of the energies that allow these ideas, which are not ours personally. And the greater the idea, the more it is that we are to be like a radio that allows these energies to move through us. If we overly personalize with them, they will make us crazy, especially some of the archetypal energies. And you find that when people get lost in their egos. They've not been actors. They've not understood that whether you're playing a murderer or a saint, you are allowing those energies to move through you, you are learning from them, and there is indeed a great truth when you are experiencing them, But you have this capacity not to over-identify with them, which means you're not then in the process of having to defend. You're in the process of performing, and that's the difference. I think we have a type of audience mind in terms of these esoteric and deeper traditions. And what I say is we must develop much more of a theater mind that's saying that the reason the play comes alive is because we enter into it. We allow the words to move upon us, and we use that to explore the nature of perception, because we are not, again, standing on the outside of it, but we're actually experiencing it from the inside. And that's why I think that art, you know, there's the old saying, like can only be known by like. And what I find most reassuring about what's been happening to me and through me is that because of this approach, which is much more about theater, about embodiment, about connection to the deeper passionate root of creation, that I really do feel that we are trying and seeking, as the world evolves so quickly and so many things awaken, really trying to evolve a conversation that says, like the archetypes, listen, each of us bring now to this conversation. Some of us bring a great technical, mathematical perception. Some of us bring a great scientific and theoretical perception. Others of us bring art and creation. Others of us bring music and poetry. But we have to be much more Renaissance, which wasn't which of us are right and who is wrong. But in the Renaissance, we're saying, listen, every question about being human demands different tools. So if you're going to know the artistry of who and what you are, if you're going to know the true quality of creation, what tools must you use? Your artistry and creation. You cannot sit outside of love and comment on it and say it doesn't exist because it's not discernible mathematically. That's a different story. You have to enter into it and say, ah, it exists, but not in this story, but in this one. And guess what? It's a wheel, so they're all my story, rather than who's right and who's wrong.
I have a question, Lee. You mentioned the sin of the past, of being too attached to numbers. And that's a kind of a fascinating sort of tidbit of history. And what I'm curious about, because it's actually what you're basically saying makes a lot of sense to me, because as Gene and I are doing our next issue on mathematics and the mathematical construct of the universe, because we've done a lot of the other things for a while and we thought we'd go there, but I think what was interesting to me is when you look at it, you still have to, in order, like when you look at the radiance of what we radiate is one thing, but what we magnetize in another. So feeling is really what we bring into play into our own world. So that's a key to me. But I guess if you get too analytical, which is what you're saying, then you lose the emotion. So having worked with kids for a long time, you can see a lot of them come in that are really bright, that have the photographic memory. But then at the same time, how does one have both parts of the hemisphere? And in order to be complete, the left and the right need to merge. And that's what I hear you saying. You need, you know, both of them are important and key.
Well, I have felt that is the right angle in the human heart. When we think of the chalice, we think of the right angle. Why do we see those images over and over again? And why do we think about the two hemispheres of the brain? I realize that the great journey of the last thousands of years is, how do I hold a sense that I am uniquely myself and not you? And we can look at that as I think, therefore I am. Because when I think I'm not you. I think I am myself. But then we have the other hemisphere, the knowledge of I love, therefore I am. Because when I love, I know I am you. When I love, I know I am composed of the weave of the whole of creation, that I am whole and holy, but that I am not whole and holy at the expense of others, but actually they are as well. So I start to honor the fact that all, in namaste, I honor the God within you. I honor that which is our essence, the quality of creation. And I really believe that that's been this crucible of the human journey of, how do I hold, I love, therefore I am, and I think, therefore I am. And that when we look at I think, we have the mathematics of creation. But also when we have I love, we have what was known as mathesis, which is really taking us back to Pythagoras, which is not, we have a very Western modern overlay of Pythagoras, because we don't want to listen to the truth that he was an adept, and his story was not to teach math as abstraction, but math as archetype, entity, monad, meaning that we are consciousness, and that the genius of consciousness is that it can and is inherently composed of mathematical principles, but that the mathematical principles are not what create creation. They are an aspect of the manifestation of the sheer beauty and true meaning of creation. So math was not used as a proof. It was actually used as a philosophical vehicle, meaning that if we understand this perception of ourselves in relationship to creation, then we will ultimately understand that although we have unique geometries ourselves, a unique blossom, a unique capacity, we are still woven of the one creation. And this is what my painting, I did a TEDx talk called The Painting Phoenix Arise and the Blossom.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yep, go ahead.
And this I think, is the best example of math and creation I've ever seen, mm-hmm. because I painted Phoenix Arise, a 5-foot by 7-foot painting, which essentially is the rectangle of the golden section. And what is so extraordinary is that I printed it in card form, this painting of creation, and when I dropped them, and this is what I talk about in the TEDx talk, through happy accident or, you know, spontaneous implication, when they mirrored each other, they create a holographic double helix DNA from a painting. And that's when I went, aha, this is actually like is revealing like. Painting is our first language. The visual language is the universal language. And that as I saw this universal language of painting, and I started to think about painting, I said, what is painting? Painting is the act of spontaneous creation, hopefully created with love. And I thought, isn't that what a human being is? We are a spontaneous act of creation, hopefully created with love. We do not come from math. We come from life, the first principle. This is very important because this then starts to say, literally in a manifest form, this is not me theoretically speaking, this is me looking at what I am looking at, and I'm sure it could be interpreted 1,000 different ways, and hopefully it will be, but from my perception, what I see, interestingly enough, of this painting called Phoenix Arise, and we think of the mythic story of the phoenix bird of immortality and rebirth that returns after 500 years, builds a nest, it erupts into flames, and from the flames then there is the rebirth of the phoenix. Well, this painting from the DNA, I played with the cards because once I saw this DNA structure, I thought this is something way beyond anything I could have conceived of, a bit like having a child. And as I played with it, it revealed ultimately, and it was through actually an 11-year-old girl, a friend of mine's daughter at the time, we were playing with the cards, and I had seen this design, this serpent, this umbilical cord, and she just slid the card, intuited, and suddenly I saw it was going to form a circle, a mandala, and the first mandala, the first circle that revealed itself from these cards, meaning that all of the geometries were being recreated from the recapitulation of the one, the painting, Phoenix Arise, and suddenly it shows the nest. And then I pulled out the cards, and as I pulled out the cards, the nest starts to erupt into flames, just as in the story. But when I pulled out the cards completely, it didn't reveal random flames. It revealed a blossom. And so it tells us in a fixed visual form, meaning it will say the same thing in 10,000 years, that creation, and this goes right to Pythagoras, he said God geometrizes. But we don't ask what God geometrizes. We think he's talking about geometry. But what he would say is God geometrizes creation, the first principle. The second principle, the geometrization, helps us to understand the quality of the refraction, meaning that as in Jewish mysticism, where there's a wonderful line about God seals creations with many names. So Yod Heh Vav Heh, this relationship to the Tetragrammaton, is essentially the signature of our particular world. But were we to express that word differently, the same creation would open with different geometries, a different world, a different blossom. And this is what we see visually being proven with Phoenix Arise, because wherever the painting is opened, it creates infinite blossoms, infinite mandalas. And it also proves the point of why the Pythagoreans did not teach fractions. That was considered occult knowledge, because if you taught fractions to an uninitiated person, they would not understand that two-thirds, they'd think two-thirds of a dog is a dead dog. To have a dog, you must have whole numbers. So that's why archetype and entity are so important, and that's why it's very interesting with this mandala, with Phoenix Arise, it is saying, you see, in the geometrization of creation, as it opens in unique blossoms, it does so because every aspect of it contains the whole, the one, creation. So it's inherently holographic, and what's amazing is that every mandala that comes from this painting is a sun, S-U-N. So...
yeah, I have. We featured that in the Cosmic Gateway issue, and you can see the fanning and the mandalas. What it also reminds me of is, since we are crystalline structures, it is like the kaleidoscope of life, and like the Islamic tiles, it says, you know, the God doesn't really have a face. It basically says, there it is. You know, I am infinite. I am in all things.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, please go on.
No, I was just looking. I'm actually looking at the artwork now because I have the issue in front of me, but it just goes to the whole thing that I am all. I am everything. I am light. And I love what you're saying, which is basically the numbers and stuff are basically a confirmation of a way of looking at things and formulating things, but it is truly our own personal expression that we are manifesting into form. And so, again, the feel and the feeling is essential to all of it. And that's true of anybody who's going to tell you you're going to manifest anything. You can talk yourself blue in the face, but it has to have a feeling. What do you have, Gene? You have a thought?
I do. Just a question here relative, because I contributed in that issue, and as part of my, I entitled it, Every Thought is a Hologram.
Yes.
And so to elaborate on hologram, would you mind doing that? Because you used the concept of the hologram, that every part does contain the whole. And could you just, enunciate on that a little further?
What I found very interesting is that what the mandala, what Phoenix Arise really taught me and teaches me visually, is this relationship to the fractal iteration of creation, and that every element, every geometry, holds the reiteration of the whole of creation, the whole. And why this is, I think, so essential is that so long as we are within the mathematics of time, distance, and space, we stand away from the center of our experience and not realizing that we are essentially a fractal. We are essentially that which is the container of the whole of creation. Each of us are the living library. One of the great indicators I felt with Phoenix Arise was, again, because it's a painting, it's actually an art form. And so the deeper metaphor of our holographic or fractal nature being revealed through the Phoenix Arise painting is it's saying, guess what? Not only are you mathematical entities capable of great genius and insight with these mathematical tools, you are also a work of art. And therefore, to know how the fractal, the holographic nature manifests as you, you must begin to perceive that you are ultimately the ring pass knot. You are that which is the regulator that says, I will only assume this set of questions, and therefore I will reject these other questions. When I do, I will realize that that allows me not a dishonesty, but a truth that will open with certain geometries, certain perceptions, certain insights. But the key now, I believe, is to experiment, because so much of my work comes from thought experiment. It really is. Well, what if I realize there's also that level of the fractal holographic nature, which says now, like the piano you've constructed, now that you have the mathematics, dive in and remember that existence is a passionate love affair with creation. And once you trust your form enough to fall in love once again with your energy, then there can be a revelation of this fractal quality that begins to see not how am I in reflection with you, but how are you the innate embodiment of the whole and holy nature of creation, and therefore in your embodiment, I'm not looking at an incompleteness, but actually a manifestation of the whole of creation that expressing itself as you is able to explore, like an electron, a particular weave, a particular thread in this great tapestry of our human journey, our human question. And I think this is why the fractal holographic, and this is what Sophia, the relationship of the mother here, the goddess, Philosophia, wisdom, she is constantly reminding in this work, you are not born into time, you're born into creation, you are whole and holy and holographic. Therefore, if you begin to ingest, suggest, nourish yourself with the possibility that you are this as well, these qualities, because they are inherent within all creation, will begin to open within you. But they will remain dormant, they will remain latent until you yourself are willing to take absolute responsibility for the implication of exploring this. You know, so that's why, and to me, that's the, when we move from theory to art, because theory is one thing, but art or creation, and I don't mean art as a painting, I mean art as an approach. I mean when we step into curiosity rather than certainty, we actually enter into a conversation rather than into a dissertation or a monologue. We're actually entering into, I can learn from these energies and they will begin to reveal themselves. And that was what the fractal revelation of Phoenix Arise was for me. It just made me perceive that we don't need to figure these things out. We need to use all of the qualities of our intelligence, our insight, our wit, our wisdom, and a bit like having a child, finally realize that we have birth something that is following its own unfoldment.
Here's like that. On that note of unfoldment, there's two things that come to mind right now. One is that the idea of, I like that, you know, we have to initiate, and sometimes that is not an easy thing to do. Even like starting the radio show, as Jean knows. I mean, there were days where I didn't know if I hit the right button or whatever, and I'm still learning. But it takes the courage and the willingness to not always be that perfection and to be willing to go to the next step and to become those things. And so, you know, and it's like activating that seed. And sometimes we're not all willing to not be be perfect in the process, but we never will be until we, you know, until it's, but again, it's always unfolding. But that goes into question, but you've had your own journey, and you've had many different things that you've done. And so I think as much as we like you say, we're cosmic, and we're not just on this timeline, so I do believe that we've had other times where we've been seated, and we've evolved. And so in this lifetime, you've been an actor, you're an artist, you're a philosopher. So there's a great deal of wisdom and things that accumulate in this particular time for you to be this magnificent gift to humanity. So why don't you explain your journey and wondering at one point, I mean, you've created your own tapestry at this point, and now that we know what age we both are, which is the same, you know, we can kind of connect the dots, right?
Yes, and we
can see that there has been a journey, but you would never necessarily understand it along the journey.
Well, I think that when I look at my life and my life as an actor in terms of the public, in terms of that world, that reality, the part of my when I was at New York, Juilliard, studying acting, and I always thought of myself as an actor because my father was a painter, and. You know, when you're, as I say, when your dad's a painter, you find something else to do simply because painting on this, like, oh my God, I can't do that. But what was interesting is that he was very, both of my parents were remarkable in their own way. My mom was a teacher, my dad, as I said, was an artist and a lot of other things as well. What was wonderful about him, he lived such an examined life. Both of my parents were always curious. So they weren't settling for an identity that was fixed and they had to defend. I always saw, and I grew up around curious people. My dad was a great reader, so both my parents read a lot. And so we had a marvelous library and this great curiosity. And I remember that my dad would always say, know yourself, be true to yourself, and never laugh at another person's dreams. And that last line really stuck with me, that sense of never laugh at another person's dreams, that you never get to the depth of things by sitting in judgment on others. And through my process and my life, I followed the course of acting, meaning I graduated from high school early and I ended up going to college. And then I went to Juilliard, auditioned, and was accepted. And when I was back in New York, I was playing a character that I couldn't find. It was a very violent character. And so I took a page from my dad's suggestion, which is he'd say, when you can't talk about it, paint it. So I had used drawing, not as a way of being an artist, but of journaling, you know, doing a lot of automatic drawing and these strange things that come out of my head. And I thought, what is all of that? My God, there's a lot more going on than anything I've experienced. You know, I just see it coming out of my unconscious. And I think a lot of us feel that. It's like, where does this come from? Why is what I write, does it come? And I think that that's that mysterious thing that's saying, follow me. You're not going to figure this out. You're going to take the adventure because you're asking me a question. Where you're going is not something or somewhere else. It's actually you're going to call forth these deeper qualities of your own root system, meaning that by your curiosity, and this is what happened to me, you will begin to create residence for another conversation as well. And when I came out from New York, I started as a professional actor. I was very fortunate. I moved into working in television and being able to work as an actor, which is rare in itself. But I also realized that Hollywood had its conversation, and I wasn't about to say it shouldn't have that conversation. It just was what it was. People would all say, hey, it's not show art, it's show business, kid. You know, and I realized that you know, part of my love of the artistry of our humanity and that sense of theater, the sense of the creative inquiry rather than the financial inquiry, you know, what's your last job, how much did you make, and what's your demographic questions. The other questions were always about what's your source, what inspires you, how do you draw from all of these sources to cultivate a performance, to cultivate a story. And so I started, as I said, with discussion groups in my home 33 years ago because I took a page from the American Transcendentalists and Emerson. I thought, if the conversation's not in that world, then have it where you live. Begin to create the condition where the conversation of shared enthusiasm can actually dwell, because the conversation in the world, for the most part, is the exhaustion that comes from trying to figure out how to make something of oneself, how to get somewhere, how to do something, how to get a project off the ground. And we get so involved in that that we forget to honor this other curiosity that we have that says, listen, this is in the quiet of the not knowing, of the not proving, but by the attending, this curiosity over time will grow. And that's why, for me, I have this double track, one being an arc of the collective. You know, when I was doing the TV show Dallas, you know, I was the groom on top of the wedding cake, you know, so there's like millions of people seeing this image. But what was interesting for me was it allowed me, almost like a puppeteer, to have a persona that was that story, that allowed me to work privately away from the world in a way that could cultivate then on a private level conversation with people that carried this sense of enthusiasm, the sense of curiosity. So that's why I was so fortunate in my work on the tarot. I was able to actually read the rough draft and then the final version with this group of individuals that I had such admiration for, that by the time I was done, that the seal of approval from this circle of individuals was so much more meaningful to me than any reviewer that was just looking at the book from the outside. I realized that to a great degree, not as a conceit, but just as a need, I had created an alternative vehicle in my home. And I almost feel like that's the footprint of our story, Karen, because we have had this story of making our way in the world, being defined by the world, what the world thinks of us, expects of us, what we expect of the world, and that's one side of it. To me, that's the I think, therefore I am. I think I am frustrated. I think I need a job. That whole story. But the other one is the story of I love. I love being human. I love this gift of being alive. I haven't figured out how I got one of these things called a human body and a human consciousness. So I might as well enjoy the mystery of it. You know, and this is why I feel like that's the two hemispheres. And the private hemisphere is saying, I want you, like when you're home and naked in a room alone. I want that level of intimacy in the relationship with your truth now. Don't give me the truth of the outer world of, I'm going to prove to my neighbor he's wrong and his politics are corrupt. I'm going to be against them. But actually to incorporate that sense of when you're at home, you realize, especially when you're in the library, wait a minute, you're part of a conversation of being human that transcends any capacity to take sides. I say, stand in a library and draw a line and tell me what authors you're for and what authors you're against. Because at a certain point you realize what's so magnificent about being human, the absolute genius of this place, is that we are in a conversation that we cannot comprehend. So it tells us, find a way to tell the truth that allows you to navigate that outer world, that shared field of assumption, your particular time, your particular conditions, but also remember to fall in love with this gift of being human that will really allow you to finally return home. Because when we're home, what happens? Our humanity simplifies. It really does become simply storytelling, painting.
Okay, I have a question for you, Lee. This reminds me of two things. One is it's you know, when we're going back to Adam and Eve, and I'm going to go back because it's almost as though what you've done is you've defined your own world. You've created your own world instead of it defining you. And I'm wondering if that is, in a sense, part of that forbidden fruit. If there was an element that was like part of with Joseph Campbell or Michael Mead would talk about the hero's journey. The hero's journey is to find your identity and your seed in the midst of all of it instead of being kind of sheeped. And that goes back to me with the idea of eating the forbidden fruit, which is the serpent in a lot of the stories. But in some places, you know, it's he's not a bad guy, but in the Adam and Eve story, he's a bad guy. So it just is sort of a closing in a sense. I mean, where is it that we in this forbidden fruit, is that the fruit of self?
I always quote William Blake, who said something wonderful. He said, I must create a system of my own or be enslaved by another man's. And I think that the creative, imaginative mind feels that way. I can't resolve to be a follower. I can't allow, you know, there's something in me that doesn't allow me to simply be in lockstep with orthodoxy. And I think that that's very important because that starts to help us to perceive that it's not those that are orthodox that there's a problem or they're wrong as much as that we really are all actors playing different roles in this huge conversation of being human. And the interesting thing about the forbidden fruit, I think wherever the creative and imaginative energies exist, we cannot stop at the doors others have assumed is the door you do not open. We are the ones, like as they say, we rush in where angels fear to tread, because it is that desire to leave no stone unturned and a curiosity that transcends any fear of the outcome of that curiosity. And I think that that might be key, because the serpent, especially in my work, because the serpent becomes a reoccurring theme, but the serpent here becomes connected to the umbilical connection to creation, and that the severing of the serpent is actually when we severed our own connections to our divine knowing. So everything having to do with what we call the feminine, meaning life, birth, mystery, love, creation, became feared. And as fear grew from generation to generation, the serpent went from being the embodiment of evolution, the knowledge of this umbilical connection, and the knowledge of the Great Mother. It really falls forward in time. It becomes phallic. And the serpent is the oldest symbol there is. And what's interesting about it is you can look at the serpent symbolism as a type of journey through human consciousness and what we think of as what we are and who we are. And for us, of course, in the world of the Father, in the world of I think, therefore I am, the serpent becomes that which is fearful, because it's that which is essentially what we would think of as our energetic being that can't be controlled, that like the ocean can only be navigated, and that if we try to control it like the ocean, she will absolutely drown us for our arrogance. And so it's an interesting story about the serpent here, and about why this reassertion of the serpent energy is so important, is because when we think of it, it's actually saying that you have, like a tree, disconnected from your own ancient energies. So anything that is of this ancient energy seems to be either alien or fear-invoking, but like any, as you say, anything that we step into and we're afraid of, but ultimately we are transformed because of our willingness to step into that fear and to be transformed by the journey through it, like the hero's journey, we end up at the end of the day making friends with the serpent. We end up making friends with our, and we begin to make sense of the story. Why did the serpent fall on its belly? What was that? And in this story, it's saying that the serpent was an interconnected holographic field wherein there was great harmony. And this serpentine energies, these qualities of motion, were in equilibrium. But our great question as human, because we didn't come from not knowing in this myth here, it says we came from vast knowing. And the reason we came here was we wanted to experiment with unique creation. And to do this, we would have to forget who we were. We'd literally have to cut this serpent. We would cut the, and you have, I mean, Tiamat and about, there's so many different relationships to the serpent. The severing of the serpent, the splitting of the serpent in two, and that becomes this story of these are our ancient energies that separated, but in the separation, it allows our humanity to evolve because it disconnects us from our divine knowing. When we do not know and we cannot remember, we are forced to bring out of ourselves through our own creative engagement the tools to survive, but also the tools to make sense of ourselves. So that's why the serpent then becomes a very integral part of who and what we are and is actually returning in a lot of symbology, saying now you are able to reconnect because you realize, and think about fear. What is the serpent? People are scared to death of serpents. And this is much more of a psychological revelation than something real in terms of our reaction to these ancient archetypal figures and forms.
Well, I can see where the ancients before, you can see some of them are snake worshippers in the sense that they would try to entrance them, and others were being consumed by them that were so large they look like pythons.
It's
interesting. So we're about ready to close the show. Is there anything, Lee, that I haven't asked you that you'd like to convey to the audience? It's been really a pleasure listening. I've learned. I love the way you
feel that, like what we're doing, Karen, is that all of us are trying to connect the dots, trying to create a context for being human that we can live with. And we start to understand that the Aquarian impulse is like actors showing up on stage to cultivate ensemble. Then we're going to stop judging why we are different, this and that. We're going to understand, no, this is an acting troupe. We're here to put on a much more interesting play together and to start trusting each other as fellow actors, fellow musicians, and to know that the play is the thing, the music that will come from all of us, is not one of us, but all of us beginning to share a greater story of who and what we are. And that's why my goal of Renaissance, the Emerging Renaissance, and Olandar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance, which is really my foundational point, is that I am convinced that Renaissance comes from shared enthusiasm, that we're far more interesting than we think. And if we attend to that, everything will change, not because we change it, but because we're willing to hold ideas that allow the change to grow naturally. So if anybody's listening, please visit my website, leemccloskey.com. On the front of my website, I have talks that I've posted that I have given in different places on different topics. And just explore the art. See where it takes you, because I don't think we have to learn anything at this point. I think we have to really give back to ourselves permission to explore and understand, like the hero's journey, what we explore will begin and always will take us on a journey, because it says, now that you've asked the question, I can finally have a relationship with you. But if you're sitting on the sideline waiting for something to come to you, realize you're an actor, and no play is ever performed by actors sitting outside of the theater, but it's performed by those who show up together and say, you know what, maybe together we can make this story far more interesting than we're trying, you know, than others are convincing us it is. The play's the thing. So let's.
Well, I actually love the way that you've created your own reality in your own space, with your own community, with your own supportive team, which I think is lovely. And that's actually taking control of your own life, having your own perspective, and being an actor on your own stage. I think that's great. So you have been quite the inspiration, so articulate, so informed. And I just want to thank you so much, Lee, for being a guest on the show and saying yes.
And thank you for asking me. Yes,
at your artwork. I just want to make sure people make sure they definitely go to your website, because that's actually how I found you when I do the magazine. I always looking for different things, and you showed up on the internet. And when I asked you to be in the issue, you were so generous and said yes. So
oh, yes.
Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being in my play.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both so much, and thank you, Karen. It was really a delight. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll see you soon.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.